I thought we'd take the opportunity this evening to talk about, rather than one particular shaila, really almost an array of shailas and issues that come up, particularly in the sug of traveling. Now, usually traditionally, these last 2 weeks in August are very, very much traveling weeks. Usually when the kids come back from camp and right before the school start, the people try to grab those last ends of summer vacation in. So although I think things are definitely, for good reasons, very limited in terms of options of traveling these days, nevertheless, I still think some people are trying to scrounge around and try to find ways to make even perhaps smaller kinds of family vacations more appropriate under the circumstances. So I think I do get a sense there's a little bit of a traveling mode. And myself, we actually went away last week for a couple of days. So although it was definitely a significantly more local trip than our annual pilgrimage to Israel. But so I think that it is a good time to familiarize ourselves with some of the shailas, some of the basic issues that do come up. They're fairly similar kinds of shailas that almost come up all the time on trips. Actually, this particular season, maybe slightly different ones come up, but we'll try to familiarize ourselves with some of the Rashi Prachim we should be aware of in the realm of traveling. So whether or not one is planning any form of a vacation in the next 2 weeks, still hopefully at some point it'll be the mice for everybody. So one of the issues that come up in terms of traveling is really the unique halachas related to chas tefillah, those unique tefillahs that revolve around traveling itself. And the two tefillahs that I'm referring to, one is tefillah sederach and one is bechas hagomel. So let's take just a step back and try to get a little bit of background to these two halachas. So tefillah sederach is the gemara that appears in the fourth parak of Masechet Brachos. It's interesting, it's not an explicit mishnah, it's not an explicit brisa. It's actually, the Gemara tells us that that Eliyahu HaNavi explained to one of the Amoraim that before you go on a trip, you should say the following. You should say the following tefillah. You're supposed to recite these words. So it is a halacha. It is a little bit of a strange source, but it is codified in the halacha in Shulchan Aruch. There's a requirement to recite that tefillah sederach. There is a big question about tefillah sederach. Just exactly what is this tefillah sederach? What's strange about it is, because we're not even sure, is it a tefillah? Is it a bracha? I mean, we colloquially call it tefillah sederach, but we're not even quite sure what it is. What makes it so strange, tefillah sederach, is the nusach, the text of tefillah sederach, doesn't seem to fit into the regular scheme of things in the following sense. We know that there's a rule in brachos that all brachos begin with the words Baruch Hashem, and some brachos conclude with the Baruch Hashem as well, Kiddush, Abel, etc., whereas other brachos are just one simple line, Barbarat, Masnach Barat, Anich Tefillin. So you have brachas tzaros, brachas aruchos, brachas that have longer themes to them, brachas that have chasivos, that have conclusions to them. But all brachas begin with the words baruch. The only exception to that rule is brachas are what's called the brachas smucha l'chaverta. When you have a bracha that is preceded by another bracha, when you have a whole series of brachas, one after another, then the first bracha begins with the words baruch, and the subsequent brachas almost piggyback on the baruch of the previous brachas. That's why in the Shemoneh Esrei, the opening bracha is Baruch Hashem, and the other one is Al Gibra, Tachonin, Al Kodesh, Tachonin, Tetha, Shivenu, Slachlanu, etc. Each subsequent bracha does not begin with the word Baruch. And the same is true with Birchas HaMazon. The only exception to that rule is the last of the brachas of Birchas HaMazon, the bracha of Atav HaMeitiv, and that's for a very special reason, because Atav HaMeitiv is not really part of the text of Birchas HaMazon. It's actually a separate bracha. It was instituted at a much later date, in the days of Yavne, and it was kind of almost like tagged on to Birchas HaMazon. So that's really more the exception to the rule. But the basic rule is, whenever you have a series of brachos, then we apply the principle of brachas b'chol l'chaverta. So the bracha, because one would have expected that it would open up with the words Baruch HaShem. Why is it open up with the Hiratzon? What happens in the Baruch HaShem? So Tezis and Maseches Pesachim throws their hands up and say, the answer is, because it's not really a bracha. It is a bakosha. It is a tefillah. It's a tefillah that ends with the words Baruch HaShem, but it's not halachically categorized as a bracha. And Tosfos actually gives other examples of these kinds of tefillah / brachas. Tosfos suggests that what we call the bracha of a low kind of shama that's recited in the morning one waking up is also not really a bracha positive. It doesn't begin with the words bracha Hashem. So it's labeled in Allah as a tefillah rather than a bracha. Other Rishonim disagree with Taisus. The Maharam of Rutenberg seems to disagree with Taisus and say no, that the tefillah tefillas of derech is not a tefillah biyama, it's a kasha biyama. It really is a full-fledged bracha. Why doesn't it begin with baruch? So the answer is that the Maharam of Rutenberg, because it's usually a bracha smuchu l'chavrata. How is it a bracha smuchu l'chavrata? You usually recite it. If you're in the middle of traveling, you recite it right after you say brachas in the morning, or you recite it after benching, you recite it after Asher Yotzar. It's always going to come in some kind of a context of a brachas mechul chavrata. So therefore, unlike Taisus, who claims that it doesn't follow the rules of mechul brachas, according to the Rambam, it very much follows the rules of mechul brachas, and it is in fact a brachas mechul chavrata, and we're supposed to treat it as such. And one is supposed to actually try to make it into a brachas mechul chavrata. It would be enough to be ladina with the Taisus of the Rambam Rutenberg. How much does the person have to try to make it smuchul chavrata? According to Taisus, it's not at all necessary. Just take those nech whenever you want. According to Rambam Rutenberg, you have to first look for a cookie. You got to first try to go to the bathroom. You got to make a brachas shachar. You got to find some kind of bracha to tag it on to solve the problem that is otherwise does not begin with baruch. So a chiddush was mischadish to me last week. We were actually traveling to one of my family, and it came time to recite that shul sederach. So I started scrounging around. We just left the house not that long ago, and I'm scrounging around, ready in the snack bags. So it was all of like 7:30 in the morning. My wife said to me, "You know, I pack snacks for the next 4 days. Like we can wait a little bit." I said, "No, no, no. This is a very, very holy snack. This is a shame yichud. I'm looking and scrounging around for a bracha." So she made I guess some kind of a face to me. I guess she must have held my closest, but I was trying to be chashish from Rabbi Rutenberg. So then I noticed that I was looking around for tefillah derech, filling bags in the back of the car. So I did something that I don't like to usually do, but I went onto my phone, onto my app, and left from derech, and I scrolled down a little bit, and I found tefillah derech, and I said tefillah derech. So I noticed that on the app, the tefillah derech happened to have been on the in the tefillah section, I think, not in the bracha section. And somebody else pointed out to me that I think probably in a different app, it's in the bracha section, not in the tefillah section. My favorite machlokes app, machlokes rishon, as in Rabbi Rutenberg, is it a bracha or is it a tefillah? So I called upon him, we're all very ready to go. We're out to recite the tefillah derech, but we're not quite sure when and where we're supposed to recite the tefillah derech. So the Gemara gives us some kind of guidelines about it should be a real trip, it's out of the city limits, etc. It gets a little bit trickier to figure out exactly what the modern day application that is. A general rule that many like to give is that if a person is doing what's almost like a regular commute, you're driving over the George Washington Bridge every day, so one can argue that it may technically, halachically, possibly be quote-unquote required until it's definitely out of the city limits, but it's hard to believe that that's our derech. Whereas a person's going on a trip, so that was more of a getting a trip, so that would probably be more of a requirement of a tzedakah. We went last week to New Hampshire. I don't consider New Hampshire to be my commute, although I have to be honest, it took us less time to get to New Hampshire than it takes me sometimes to cross over the bridge, not this season, but sometimes during the year. So that was considered to be a real derech. The post can point out that if one is traveling, in a couple of days, so every day you recite a mitzvah of derech, one need not wait until one leaves the city limits for the neutral snack. So if you're leaving a motel room and you're going out, you're going touring somewhere in Maine, whatever it is, then you can say tefillah snack right away because you're already considered to be, in a sense, hechzik baderech. So tefillah snack is one tefillah of bracha, whatever it is, that's associated with traveling. And then there's another bracha that's associated with traveling, and that's the bracha of Birchas HaGomel. So Birchas HaGomel, the Gemara tells us here in the ninth bracha of Masechet Brachos, that under certain circumstances, a person is required to recite Birchas HaGomel, Abot Tzrichim Lahodos. And one of the people who is required Lahodos is someone who's a Yerdei Hayam, someone who travels over the ocean. So how does that play out for us, Bizman Hazeh? So there seem to be three different opinions in the Gedolei HaPoskim as to what their modern day rabbi say that the whole idea of Yerdei Hayam is that it was a dangerous, very dangerous shipwrecks. And whereas today, Baruch Hashem, the travel, even if you're passing over the ocean, you're flying over the ocean, is Baruch Hashem not all that dangerous. And therefore, there really is no need to recite the Birchas HaGomel. One should not be recited Birchas HaGomel. That was the view that the Rav subscribed to. And others disagreed. Moshe Feinstein disagreed, and Moshe said, and even though it's true, perhaps statistically, flying is very, very safe, nevertheless, chalila b'chalila, the consequences, the ramifications of an accident are so profound, even bisman hazeh, that it's still considered to be a makom sakona. It's a type of sakona you're allowed to subject yourself to, but it's still considered to be a makom sakona to fly. And therefore, Rav Moshe said that whether you're flying over the ocean, you're flying domestically, the air, the yom, doesn't matter all that much. So many of the Rishonim, including where we pass in Shulchan Aruch, hold that the examples that the Gemara gives, the Yodei Yom, Chalosh and Shrap, etc., are only examples. If a person experiences other makamas of sakana, other situations, circumstances of sakana, one would also be required to recite Pirch Sagomel. So therefore, Moshe writes, he thinks that flying is objectively considered to be a makam sakana, even bizman hazeh, and therefore all flights, even a very, very short domestic flight, one would be required to recite a Pirch Sagomel. So you have two extremes. If the Rav who thought the Pirch Sagomel for flying basically doesn't exist today, and according to Rabbi, it should exist all the time. Then you have what seems to be the third opinion, which I'm not sure I can pin down who exactly says it, but it seems to be the pretty common practice today, is that a little bit of a split, that if it's really, truly Yard Yom in the sense of you're flying over the ocean, so then one would recite Pirch Sagomel. If you're not flying over the ocean, you're just flying domestically, so then one would not recite Pirch Sagomel. Again, that seems to be somewhat of a compromise. It seems to be a very popular opinion, Bizman Hazeh. The post can point out that when a person recites Pirch Sagomel, you're really supposed to say it soon after the nais, so the Machos HaKana was experienced. The person's going to say Pirch Sagomel for a flight 56 years ago, so that's really going to lose the whole oomph. So I remember we had an interesting shaila that goes back to it was two nights after Purim this past year. So it was we were davening Ma'ariv in the shul, and we knew at the time that was going to be the last minyan in shul for quite some time. I don't think in our wildest dreams we anticipated how long that was going to be, but it was at the point where the shuls were about to all be closed in Bergen County the following morning, and it was literally the last Ma'ariv. So in addition to announcing it, reminding everyone to take a thousand tefillin home for an indefinite amount of times, so I also noticed at the time that there were two bacharim who had just made it back from Eretz Yisrael. One of them was my son, another boy in the community, and I knew that I literally just picked myself on the airport that day. Everyone was, those remember back to post-Purim days when it was the crisis, the scrounging to get everybody out of Eretz Yisrael. Now we have the crisis the other way around, trying to figure out how to get everybody back into Eretz Yisrael. So we've changed a little bit in terms of the direction of the problem, but the basic fundamental airways hasn't been solved yet. So we got my son home. Literally, as he left through Shalayim, as Shushan Purim was coming to an end, so he literally left through Shalayim and got on a flight home. So I realized that my rib. I said, wait a second. I have no idea when he's going to get the opportunity to say Pirch Sagomel. I'm knitting in our family as we do say Pirch Sagomel if I'm flying back in these Eretz Yisrael. So I had no idea when he's going to get in the next Kriyas HaTorah. Hey, who knows when Kriyas HaTorah is going to be. It's a good thing I didn't wait for the next Kriyas HaTorah because that week was Pashas Kisisa. The next Kriyas HaTorah in our show was Pashas Noso. So that would have been quite a long time. So I sat on the spot both to him and to the other boy. I said, you better say Pirch Sagomel right now. Even though we have a custom, it's a custom not to recite Pirch Sagomel at night because Pirch Sagomel is Ka'en, the carbon toda that's brought, and you don't bring a carbonus at night. It's only a minute, and then if you're really stuck, you're not going to be able to recite it. And the other time you're allowed to recite a mikra did at night as well. So that's exactly what we did. So the two boys, one was going to the other, and recited Pirch Sagomel. Otherwise, we got to wait 3 months to have another opportunity because Pirch Sagomel really has to be recited in the minyan. Having said Torah is not the end of the world. That's also only a minyan, but not having a minyan, that's the problem. That's a real din. Halacha is that you do require a minyan. Yeah, I'm sorry.
So on the Tfilas HaDerech thing, I think that Rav Shlomo Zalman used to hold that when you traveled from Tel Aviv or Bnei Brak to Yerushalayim, that you didn't do a Tfilas HaDerech for that trip because he also didn't view that as really Yotze
L'Derech. It was more of a daily kind of a trip of a commute more than a Derech, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's a smart that some posts can have. Yeah. It's not exactly where that idea comes from, but there are some posts can have.
As the Rav started, at what point did the Rav say Tfilas HaDerech?
Oh, very good. That's also a question. It means at what point should a person say Tfilas HaDerech? So we usually, I usually tell people to say Tefillas HaDerech when they're kind of out of the general comfort zone, so to speak. But they're really, what they consider to be as a muhsak b'derech. So I'm trying to remember how we went. So we drove up through Hampshire, went up 95, up till towards the direction of Boston, and then veered off. So it's kind of hard for me to say, you know, I get onto Route 4 and take it to the bridge and then get onto the Cross Bronx. And you should say a lot of other tefillos on the Cross Bronx, but I don't know if tefillos are there. So it's kind of hard for me to, you know, to say tefillos are there as I'm driving past the marina. You know, then you get a little bit further in and I get to Stanford. I mean, I go to Stanford once in a while. I don't remember exactly what point I felt comfortable exactly saying tefillos are there. Maybe once I was ready. And maybe when the hush became the merit, I don't know. I don't remember the exact Nakuda. Usually, I think in terms of the mountains, I know that there always was, it was like this unwritten minig about going up to the mountains when you get out to New York 17. You know, Coast Mine is still in the throughway. The throughway, you still feel like you're part of civilization. Once you start to, you know, you're past Woodbury Commons, you finish a shopping spree, so then you're already mountain bound. So that's like a different, that's almost like more of a trip kind of mindset. Again, none of this is rocket science. This is more of a little bit of a hergish. When you speak a little bit about tefillos and brachas, especially concerning traveling, so we shouldn't forget some of the regular halachos in Gavinos, those tefillah, that sometimes get thrown into question. Again, this most of us are not taking flying these days, but flying always adds a whole dimension of tefillah issues, particularly relating to the issues of Zman tefillah, that one very often finds themselves in a situation where they have to daven at a time that's not optimal in terms of a way before the regular Zmanim. So the regular Zmanim usually indicate, begin with Netzachama. One is not really L'chadchil, according to many, supposed to daven Shemoneh Esrei until sunrise. Now, this time of the year, it's still fairly early sunrise, but other times of the year, it can get rather late. So L'chadchil, one is not supposed to daven Shachar or sunrise. However, not everybody agrees to that. The reason why not everyone agrees to that is based on the Mishnah Maseches Megillah. The Mishnah in Maseches Megillah tells us that any mitzvah that's supposed to be done during the day, L'chadchil should not be done until sunrise. The reason for that is, even though technically the halachic day begins well before sunrise, at the time of dawn, Alos HaShachar, but mid the Rabbanan, Chazal were concerned, if you're going to blow shofar right after Alos HaShachar, so you may goof and you may blow a little bit too early. You're going to shake a lulav right after Alos HaShachar, you may miss it by a minute and do a little bit too early, then you wouldn't be yotzei from that Torah. So Chazal instituted to wait till the sunrise. The sunrise is already so much light around, no one's going to make a mistake, no one's going to realize it's ready at the right time. So the Chatchili is supposed to try to do the mitzvah at the point of Netzachama. So there are some Acharonim who suggest that Chatchili doesn't apply to Shemoneh Esrei, right? Because Shemoneh Esrei is connected to Kamen Tomid, and the Kamen Tomid they actually used to bring before Netz, which says explicitly, and then the basic mitzvah itself, they were much more careful, they didn't have to wait until Netz. Some suggest that when we daven shachar, we don't have to wait until next either. And others disagree with that. So again, there are different opinions about that. L'chadchila, we try to avoid davening before next, unless one is what's called an halacha mashkim aderech. If a person has to get up early, he has to go somewhere, he has to go to work, he has to travel, he has to do something, so then one can even l'chadchila daven before next. So it doesn't have to be such a tremendous shachar. Who's afraid they're going to miss their plane, so that would be sufficient grounds to daven before next. Now, very often people have these kinds of shilas about should I daven on the plane, should I daven in the airport, those kinds of things. As a general rule is, one should try to avoid, whenever one can avoid davening on planes, avoid davening in airports, that's always a great thing to do. Whenever one is absolutely stuck, then it really depends on the context of where one is. If it's going to be any degree of a chil Hashem or anything, obviously that trumps any davening whatsoever. If it's going to be done in a way that doesn't create a chil Hashem, so then one has to just use common sense in terms of davening in these kinds of places. Again, years ago, maybe it was considered to be more mekubal to daven or toss and fill on a regular domestic flight. It's probably less mekubal these days. But again, these are things that are not absolutely ironclad. These are things that depend on a little bit more on the context. I think as a general rule, in today's world, it's probably not the best idea to be davening, unless you're davening flying to Eretz Yisrael. It's probably not the best idea to be davening in a Talis and Tefillin on a regular airline. Of course, other areas of halacha that come up when one is traveling. So obviously one of the most common two things just to be aware of, issues that come up sometimes in Chol Shabbos that we're not so familiar Daf Yomi just began with says Erevin, 105 left to go in this area. So there are two important sugyas that come up that can, two or three important sugyas that come up that are impacted very much by traveling. One is the issue of tchumen. So tchumen is something that we almost don't think about because we live in big cities. So we who live in Teaneck very, very rarely have to think about tchumen, because in order for tchumen to be a problem, you have to first get out of your halachic city limits. After you're out of your halachic city limits, then you're not allowed to walk 2,000 amos. So the way our houses and our streets and our towns are set up, so you can go for miles and miles and miles before you get out of your halachic city limits. So when a person wants to walk from one end of Teaneck to the other, that's not going to be a problem. You walk from Teaneck to Englewood to all the areas, pretty much in our not literally Dalat Amos, but extended Dalat Amos, so one wouldn't have to be too worried about home. The minute that a person is out in the country, one's out in the areas which are not as built up, so then all of a sudden, Chumun is something that one has to be concerned about. So actually, we were in New Hampshire, so there was a map that was hanging up in a place where people were davening. There was a map that was hanging up with somebody had done some work on the Chumun, places that were not all that far from one another. Chumun Shabbos is a very, very short walk. 2,000 amos is an very, very small amount of space. It is the amount that distance that an average person walking at an average pace is about an 18-minute walk. That is really not all that far. So there was a big map showing you the different areas about where one has to be concerned with in terms of Hilchus Tchumen. That's one area one should just be aware of. One is out in the mountains or other areas, one should just in contact with somebody to find out what the status of the Tchum Shabbos is. Another issue that comes up is the issue of carrying. Again, we live in communities that most of us grew up our entire lives with Erevin, so we tend to forget that one of the third and ninth malacha is carrying. It's always nice every couple of years that Rosh Hashanah falls down on Shabbos, so we get a reminder you're not allowed to carry on Shabbos. That's why we don't blow shofar. It's a strange thing, even though we do everything else. We carry machzor, we carry talisim, but we don't blow shofar. That's the chazal misakin. It's a low plug, so even though the reason doesn't apply to most of our communities, that's the way it is. It's interesting, a Rav just told me the other day, had an interesting, fascinating insight. He said that maybe he'll ashamed him and said, count that to Ruch HaKadosh, maybe a lot of Ruch HaKadosh, that he knew that there's going to come a year, Rosh Hashanah Tavshin Pei Aleph, Rosh Hashanah Bolin L'Toiva, which is probably the biggest concern in who knows when, of Shem Yaf Renad Al Hamas B'Shus HaRavim. We know that Kishoyfa this year and many shows is going to be a little bit different. There's a lot of maneuvering and tumbling about blowing indoors, blowing outdoors, and different minyan and outdoors, indoors, and what the safest way to blow the shofar is going to be. So there may be people not coming to show altogether. So there's going to be an array of different potential carrying and moving of shofars in a way that would never, ever have taken place in a regular Rosh Hashanah. So this is the best year possible for Rosh Hashanah B'Shabbos. Because if Hashanah would have been if it would have blown shofar on Shabbos, so no doubt somebody would have carried the shofar Shlokedin. What Chazal were concerned about would have happened this year. So if Ruach HaKadosh, of the Hillel Shem, command the Luach over 1,500 years ago, that this was not a good year to blow shofar on Shabbos. But again, one has to be aware of the fact that obviously there's no Erev, so one is not permitted to carry. I always get questions this time of the year from people who are in different places. They're in backyards and they're in rented houses and bungalows and all kind of stuff. They're trying to figure out, are they allowed to carry in these areas or not? So the basic, again, obviously we're not going to summarize 105 lot in 3 minutes, but the basic rules are in a certain sense fairly simple. Namely, the area has to be completely surrounded by walls. That if the area is totally surrounded by walls, then one's allowed to carry there. A wall is defined by something that is more than 10 tefachim tall. 10 tefachim are different opinions, somewhere approximately 3 feet, a little bit more according to others, that the area has to be surrounded by halachically acceptable walls. I'm going to say all four sides, they don't really literally mean all four sides, but just about all four sides. So you can have little breaks here and there in the walls, but they have to be little breaks. And there are two things that one has to be aware of, that if you have an area that's more broken, more breached than wall, so that loses its status as a wall. Or if you have a big, big gap with 10 amos in a wall, that also has daf yom yesterday's daf. The first missionary of Yosem Yasser Amos can disqualify the entire wall. That's called a pirza rather than a pesach. And then the third thing to be aware of is if there are any breaches, any breaks in the corners of any area, that could also potentially disqualify that whole area. So again, the first thing to look for in these kinds of places is the area really surrounded. So if you're staying in a house and there's a backyard, it's totally surrounded by a fence. So a little break in the fence to walk through, that's also okay. But short of walls, then it starts to get very, very tricky. Then you have to start to rely on Tiras HaPesach. That's the first mission also in Erevin. That's the putting up two poles and putting screens. Of course, that's obviously way beyond the scope right now. So if a person wants to start putting up their own Erevin, then they really have to consult with somebody who can walk them through how to do the Erevin properly. So one should not just take the attitude, well, it's a small area, it's a backyard, it's a private backyard, and therefore there's nothing to worry about. That's not at all correct. Being private is not the key. The more important thing right now is that the area is properly, halachically surrounded with mechitzos. Even if an area is completely surrounded with mechitzos and walls, there is still a problem if carrying there, if it has access to more than one family, more than one person. So let's say you have two people who are sharing a backyard. Each one has their own house and you open it up to a backyard. So that's a problem. That's what's called Erev Chatzeir. It's a special din that was instituted in the days of Shlomo HaMelech. Those are the sugyas in the sixth parak and beyond the Maseches Erevin. And even though the area is a Rishus HaYochid min HaTorah, and although min HaTorah you're allowed to carry there, but min Derabbanan you're not allowed to carry there because it has there are more than one access, one private area, that poses a problem in the Rabbanan. The way to solve that problem is for the multiple dwellings to join together through the principle called an Erev Chatzeiros. That's what we do in all of our communities. When we surround all our areas with walls and fences and Tiras HaPesach and wires, etc. And then we make Erev Chatzeiros. Then everybody chips in to buy a piece of matzahs, for a box of matzahs. And since everybody has a share in the Erev Chatzeiros, so then and only then are you permitted to carry in that area. So we don't literally walk around town collecting pieces of matzahs. The rough in town goes to the store, buys a box of matzahs, and gives it to somebody else to be zoiche on behalf of the entire community. When I had to do it every Erev Pesach, the customers to redo the Erev Chatzeiros, the matzahs tend to get stale. So I mentioned this earlier in one of the shiurim, but when we had to redo the Erev Chatzeiros on Erev Pesach this year, so the general practice is that you go to store, you buy a box of matzahs and you give it to the neighbor, give it to somebody to be zoicha on the box of matzahs. So if you recall, on Erev Pesach was not exactly the time that anybody wanted to go to anybody's house and to hand anybody matzahs. Everyone was staying at the far away from everybody at that time. And you're not really supposed to be Erev Chatzeiros with people in your direct family who are being supported by you. So it's always like a catch-22. The people who are in your family unit, or you're in your bubble, so to speak, are the people who probably can't be zoicha on Erev Chatzeiros. You have to go looking for an outsider, which you don't want to have to do. So what we did was, there is no din that you have to mamash hand it to the outside. The outside has to be zeichan, has to pick it up. So I called one of my neighbors and I said, okay, listen, I'm coming across the street. I'm going to stand very, very far away from you. You come out of your house, I'm going to put the box of matzahs down on the street. I'm going to take 20 steps back and you're going to come and pick up the box of matzahs. Have in mind to be zeichan, whoever had to be zeichan the matzahs. So we had to do that both for the Erev Chatzeiros and we had to do it for the Erev Shilim as well. So the same bismuth. So we had our distant virtual Zechian Erev in these past Yom Tov. Anyway, getting back to the story. So if one finds themselves in these kinds of setups, we have multiple people in the same area, so you have to worry now about Erev Chatzeiros. In addition to Erev Chatzeiros, if there are any non-Jews who are involved in these areas, you have to go to Tzuris or Shus from them. You have to rent out from them their rights. They're not part of the Erev. You have to first give them some cash, some money, very token amount, and ask them to rent out their rights in these public areas as well. This is what we do also. We rent from the mayor, so the police, different people who have that ability halachically to represent the different non-Jewish neighbors in our neighborhoods. If you're coming to some small area and you're trying to make yourself an Erev Chatzeiros with a couple of other frum families, so if there are any non-Jews around, you have to take care of that also. So these are just, again, the ABCs of what's called Tzchiris Rishus and Erev Chatzeiros one should be aware of when traveling. Very often, one finds themselves traveling in such a scenario where you may not even need an Erev Chatzeiros because you're not really an owner and you're not even really a renter. Now, sometimes, depending on what your rental agreement is, sometimes you rent the place, you rent this particular house for the next 6 weeks. Sometimes you just you go to the Days Inn and you rent a room in a hotel. So if you just rent your room in a hotel, there are some folks who can say, you're not even really a renter because technically they're not bound to keep you in that room. Yeah, but they're probably not going to switch you in the middle of the night. But in theory, legally, there's nothing stopping them at 3 o'clock in the morning from moving you. You don't sign. When you give your credit card for a hotel room, you're not signing into room 126. You're signing to get the right to get a room. So since they theoretically can move you, there are some posts who say, you're not even a seicher, you're nothing, you're just a guest of the owner of the hotel, and maybe no Erev Chatzeres will even be needed. So there are different opinions about this. And these are general shilas when you job is just to be aware of in terms of whether it is appropriate to do a seicher as an Erev Chatzeres or whether it's not at all necessary. And again, the other issues just in terms of being aware of the issues of tchumen, the issues of carrying, things that are usually not on our radar screen on a regular Shabbos sitting around the Tinek and Bergenfield.
Rebbe, what about the hotel lobby?
The hotel lobby, if it's totally closed or even it's totally indoors?
Totally closed.
Right, it's totally closed, and then it may be required in Chatzeres, depending on what we're saying. If you make the hotel shayla and say that since the hotel owner can move anyone to any room at any time, so nobody feel like balabas, and then there wouldn't be any need for an Erev Chatzeres. You could mamish carry the hotel lobbies no matter what. According to the Machmirim, you would have to make an Erev Chatzeres and a Schiris Ushos in the hotels. There are some caterers, like when they take over parts of hotels for Shabbos, so part of the, some of the Ashkochas insist that they actually do an Erev Chatzeres. They literally do go to the manager hotel, they'll do a Schiris Ushos, they'll take some challah rolls and matzah, something, and make it actually Erev Chatzeres. And others are lenient on the Shabbos. There are different things.
My father, when he used to go to a hotel, he had smicha from a Moshe. He used to make a kinyan for the whole hotel. He used to go to the manager, and he used to buy the hotel.
Right, so that was the schiris rishos / Erev Chatzeres. Right, he was following the machmir with that child. Right. Others disagreed. Not everyone agrees to that, but there were those who held it. There are other issues that come up, particularly in the realm of kashrus. Obviously, one has to keep the stands of kashrus up the bar, even on vacation. But there are a couple of just issues that do come up in the course of traveling. One of the common issues that comes up in the course of traveling is issues related to tefillas kelim. Not always is there a kelim available at moment's notice. That's something that we, of course, had to deal with even in the heart of our own community not all that long ago. So very often you're on a trip and you realize, we brought some new stuff along, we don't have a kelim mikvah around. So your initial reaction is, we'll go to a body of water. So we spoke about this many, many times. Running off to a body of water is not so simple, because not all bodies of water are acceptable. The ocean may be acceptable, but if it's close kelim, and not everything is necessarily acceptable. Again, this is already a whole digression. One has to be very careful. And ask a shayla before one begins to use lakes and other kinds of bodies of natural water, even for tefillas kelim. One does not have the option of simply saying that, well, I use it once and that's all. There is no such din. There is no such cool. It's a little bit of a misconception. You can use a kli once. You get a green light one time. That's not true. What may be true is if it's a disposable kind of a kli, that's a different story. If it's a kli that's made to be used once, made to be disposed, so that's already a chiddush. That's a ramesh's chiddush, that such a kli would not require to this game. Not everyone even agrees to that. But that already has a basis in halacha. But if it's a regular set of silverware, you just forgot to title it, so that's a big problem. So then one would not be able to use that silverware unless you figure out an eitz how to give it to a non-Jew. That's, we spoke a lot about that back in the Tfilas Kelim Shurim earlier on in this during the beginning of the crisis. Another issue that, of course, comes up in terms of kosher standards, if a person finds himself in a hotel room or a place in a ski lodge, wherever they find themselves, and they want to be able to avail themselves of some of the kelim of that place. So which kelim are you allowed to use? So any kli that was used by a non-Jew, one has to be concerned with. And one cannot assume that it's kosher, so you have to kosher it. So how exactly to kosher these things? Depends which kind of things you want to kosher. So if a very common issue that comes up is in a hotel room and they want to kosher the microwave, so are they permitted to kosher the microwave or not? So we have a general rule, this is kosher, go kabbalah kachpolto, that the way things go in, that's the way they come out. So since things tend to go into a microwave, if there is any bleed in the microwave, whatever that degree of bleed there is, so then one could potentially kosher that as well. So there are different opinions about that. There are some posts who do not like kashering microbes altogether for a variety of reasons, but there are some mekilims, those who really feel they have to. So one could theoretically kasher a microwave by taking a cup of water, a bowl of water, and filling it up and turning on the microwave for a while until the area begins to steam up to such a degree that whatever went in is going to come out. Kabbalah kachpol. Again, there are those who question that method of kashering and those who don't like kashering in plastic in general. Kind of goes beyond the scope of right now, but there are those who would permit the kashering of microwaves under those circumstances. If one wants to kasher other kinds of devices that you sometimes find in vacation homes, such as stoves and ovens, and then whatever the regular standards of kashering for those kinds of things are, that we've spoken about very often in the past as well. So again, one just has to be careful that whenever one is dealing with hilchos kashrus, particularly on trips, that one doesn't take that attitude then of hilchos kashrus.
If you bring your own pot, is there any way to use the stovetop?
So the stovetop is me'ikra din okay, because me'ikra din, the liyas don't go, the transfer of taste doesn't go from the stovetop into your pot, provided the stovetop is clean. However, not everyone agrees to that. So although Moshe Paskin didn't want me'ikra din, there are those who would recommend to quote-unquote kasher. Kasher the stovetop wouldn't be all that hard if one just simply turned on the fire for a little while. You could fill up your pot with a little bit of water, and put it onto the stovetop, put it on the fire for a few minutes, and that's probably going to be enough, the same that many of us do before Pesach. Again, it's probably meikra din, not even necessary, as long as the stovetop is clean. There is another issue that comes up very often in terms of traveling, those issues relating to Taras HaMishpacha, in terms of Hilchos Nida. So, as we mentioned before, in terms of Tefillas Kelim, and it's true a million times over, in terms of Tefillah for women, that one should not take the attitude that any body of water is absolutely acceptable for Tefillas Nida. There's some very, very serious mechshoilim that could happen based on that. I just had a call, not just, that was about 2 months ago or so, from a certain group of people who are, I don't remember where they were, somewhere in the country, where they had gone, and then there were some quarantine rules and there were changes, and they weren't allowed to leave where they were. And you had a whole bunch of married couples who were in the middle of nowhere, and there was no mikveh anywhere around. They were there much longer than they expected to be there. And the question came up about using a certain body of water there. And again, I wasn't there. I had no idea what the body of water was. So it's not an absolute. I want to just stop be toivel in bodies of water. It depends on the source of the water, depending on how much the water is moving, whether the body of water is dammed up or not. A lot of things go into that discussion. Sometimes you have situations where it's just not practical. The mice and the woman can't get the mikvah. They're on a trip, there's no mikvah around. So what are you going to do? So obviously, I'm just talking about a pot thing. Sometimes you have a situation where she can get to the mikvah, but it's very, very difficult. It's going to be a lot of maneuvering, a lot of traveling, a lot of, finagling with kids around. So how much is the person mechuyev to be most of the nefesh to get to the mikvah that night? So the Shulchan Aruch writes that tefillah b'zman mitzvah, it is considered to be a mitzvah to go to the mikvah at the earliest possible time. But the Shulchan Aruch said the reason for that is mishum b'rei v'rivya, not that the tefillah mikvah per se is b'zman mitzvah. There are some Rishonim who say that, but we don't bask in that way. We bask in that the reason why tefillah b'zman is mitzvah is mishum b'rei v'rivya. So the couple should be able to have a better chance of having a child. So that's what the post can point out, that if that's not a reality, the couple is not at the stage of life without having children anymore, or the woman is halachically permitted to be on birth control. So you have situations where that consideration isn't there. So then we say tefillah b'zman is not really a mitzvah. It's a good thing. We should try to do it. But if both husband and wife agree that it's just not very practical and it's going to be too stressful, and they'd rather wait till they get home to go to the mikvah, so then they have a right to do so. Again, it's not an optimal setup, but they do have a right to do so if they both agree. Sometimes issues come up in terms of traveling, in terms of maneuvering a little bit, in terms of going to the mikvah earlier. Sometimes it comes out that it's significantly easier for a person to go to the mikvah maybe old yom. So that's a very, very tricky thing. And again, this is not a traveling issue, it's more of a need a shayla, but it does come up when people are out of their regular comfort zone. So the starting point is that one is not supposed to go to the mikvah during the day. So that's clear as day, no pun intended on that. That's clear to halacha, that one is not supposed to be going to the mikvah during the daytime. However, under very, very extenuating circumstances, Chazal speaking about the possibility of going to the mikvah on what's called the Tefillah Shalei Bizmanam Bayom. It's already the eighth day. It's already after she came over and she didn't get the mikvah at the right time. So then there are some danger issues, other issues. So there may be certain grounds for me going to the mikvah even in the daytime. Under very, very, very extenuating circumstances, there are some posts who are willing to talk about even the possibility on the seventh day also of going to the mikvah maybe on yom again. And this is really a case-by-case basis. And even if that's true, that would only be true if the couple are not going to be see each other, not really going to be together at all, at least not privately for sure not, until after dark. Sometimes that is just not feasible, not practical, especially in vacations and kids. So the going to mikveh in the daytime is fraught with a lot of halachic complications. So one should be very, very careful before one just takes the attitude that we're gonna, assume we're gonna be able to go to the mikveh 2 hours before dark, and because that's where we're gonna be, and then we're continuing our travels. So one should work very, very carefully with the tefillah schedule to try to plan one's vacation properly. In general, it's a good idea, especially if a couple's going on their own vacation, so then they should definitely try to plan the vacation. And again, it doesn't always work out that way, but for a time when the woman is muteris, for other reasons, the chuzdin is that a couple is not supposed to be in places that are somewhat more romantic settings, so one is not supposed to be doing that when the woman is in either. Go out for a vacation, otherwise it doesn't work out. Sometimes she gets a period early, something went wrong in the cycle, unlike the plans. So what do you do at that point? There's no need to cancel the vacation, depending on what the vacation was. If the whole vacation was very private, walking on the beach kind of vacation, so that's a problem. That's something that really is not appropriate when the woman is not mutaris. If the vacation was going to place to going to Disneyland, whatever it was. So that would be those kind of things. Definitely be okay. I remember many years ago, I asked Rabbi Willick for a Haggadah. How do you define what kind of a vacation, what kind of events are acceptable when the woman is in need or not? And his response was, something that you would do with your roommate. If you were two guys who go to Disneyland, you know, your wife to Disneyland. You have to be careful. Amusement parks are not a good place when the wife is in need. That's very difficult to practically to be in the same ride together. So you're in different cars, you can do it, but it's not, it's a little bit clumsy. So once you just a chachamina baroshel, then if it's versus nida, one should try as best as possible that the vacations, if they can be planned around their schedule in mikvah, it will solve some of the hachokas issues of chosnid. It will also solve the sometimes undue stress of trying to go to the mikvah on vacation, which again is sometimes can cause a lot of halachic and other issues. And so again, we obviously didn't have a chance to talk about everything related to traveling and vacation, but a few of the Rashi Prakim in terms of brachas and tefillas and Shabbos and kashrus and kashrus mishpacha, some of the ABCs that I found over the years, people who asked me the similar shots, keep being asked all the time, so try to give a little bit of a heads up. Those are the shots I want you to try to be aware of upon planning vacations. Okay. Be well. Good night.